Technorama episode 650, I need a vacation after my vacation. Hello and welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If this is your first time listening or joining or watching or whatever you do with us, to us, at us, for us, welcome. If you are returning, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I am Chuck Tomasi from sunny Phoenix, Arizona, and with me as always is Craig Stepp from South Carolina. How are you, Craig?
I'm doing great. I did feel like I needed a vacation after my vacation.
For a bit, yes. It's like, hey, nothing slowed down while I left home. There's still lots of projects that need doing at work and home, and why did I come back?
Yeah. You know, actually, when I came home, you know, for me, I drive 4 hours. I know you fly, but I drove 4 hours to come home. And that afternoon, evening, I just was exhausted. I was wiped. You know, I just feel like I wanted to just lay on the floor or the ground or outside, or it didn't matter. I just wanted to just be.
It took me days to kind of recover from that. But yeah, we got in, our flight landed at 10 a.m. Arizona time. So it gave us time to get Scott to his house and then do the laundry and take a nap. But I mean, like every day I was like, oh, man, it's 8 o'clock. I'm going to bed. Yeah. I'm just too tired. I don't know what it was. It wasn't like I was waking up at 3 a.m. You know, I wasn't still on Atlanta time.
Right. Well, you know, and then we turned around Friday afternoon and had to go take my son to school and set him up in his room. So we did that Friday. We went back to Atlanta on Friday and set him up on Saturday and then came back home. So it was another 4 hour journey about 4.5 hour journey.
You had to go back.
I know. So yeah, I drove back and forth. So I was in Atlanta twice within a week.
In an alternate reality, I would have been also, because there was a developer meetup scheduled for Thursday the 9th. And
that's right.
Yeah. I'm kind of glad it got canceled.
Yeah. I could have just brought you home and then took you back there for that.
Yeah. I'll just hang out with Craig for a couple of days.
Yeah. Why not?
That would have been a pretty good idea, but.
Yeah.
You got a lot of stuff in the truck. Not sure where I would have fit. No, you didn't have a truck. You got a car. You would have fit. You got a car.
We had
two buckets of Santa stuff. And anyway, we are off track. Let's get into our feedback. We have some listener feedback. We have our question of the week. And we have this cool song we like to sing.
Letters. Oh, we get letters. We get your letters
every day.
Every day.
Karaoke time. Sing it, Chuck. Retried it and pull one out.
Those letters, I love those.
I got a boarding pass.
Let's find out what you got to say.
Oh boy!
Mailman, mail today.
Why are you not karaokeing that?
Because there's no version of it without the voices.
I was going to say, do you need the words?
No, there are some songs that I can do without the words. All right, millions and billions of emails we get each week, and we reached in and pulled this one out. Okay, I may be exaggerating a little bit there. This one's from Lee John in Chandler. He says, Chuck and Craig, apologies for being 14 months behind. Okay. That's okay, because he sent us this about 4 weeks ago. And we just
So we're behind.
He said, in episode 609, oh, by the way, this is episode 650, so 41 episodes later. He said, you got a question about Plex and using a Synology NAS. I've been using a Synology for a few years now and using Plex as my video audio delivery server system. I've ripped around 400 DVDs. Well, jeez. This guy needs to talk to Joe. and at least as many CDs to the NAS as Plex does a great job. It is entirely possible to deliver video outside your home network to your mobile devices. You can sign up for a Plex account free of charge, which permits you to have other people share their content with you. One can pay for Plex server services monthly or a one-time lifetime charge, which allows you to install the server software onto your network and gives other neat stuff to play with. Plex can automatically transcode, but has limitations at the NAS that come into play. I currently have a Synology model DJ920 4-bay with a 4 terabyte rated drives. That was That was supposed to be like computer readout, but it didn't work. It's got four
didn't translate.
four terabyte rated drives. Wow, that's a healthy amount of storage, which does a good job. And I recommend looking at the stats to see how your own setups. So hope you're all keeping well. We are. Thank you very much. And we also have our question of the week. So let's dive into some of those. We had two shares. Did you share? I shared.
I did.
Did you get any responses to your shares?
No, my followers were quiet. Ugh.
Oh, man.
That's okay. That's okay. I'll get a bunch of replies tomorrow.
I got I got a few, but I think one of them is a repeat.
That's okay.
So our question of the week last week was, or last time, 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, what's an instance where the movie was better than the book? And go ahead, pick one off the Technorama list.
All right. So John Kratzer says, Outlander, Sean Connery made the movie.
Hmm. Okay. Charlotte Kennedy says, the movie ending of Good Omens was better than the book ending. I thought Good Omens was a TV show.
It was the show on Amazon Prime.
Right, we watched that. I didn't know it was a movie. But okay, what else you got?
Our buddy Steve London says, Starship Trooper, the book and the movie were completely different from each other, and both has its qualities. The movie is a lot better and easier to digest, and he loves the setting. By the way, did you know that they use the uniforms and equipment from the space infantry in Serenity from Starship Troopers? I did not know that.
I did not know that. We'll have to look again. The movie Serenity or the...
Probably the movie.
The 2005 movie. Okay.
Yeah. Right. I can go. It's about time for me to go back and rewatch Firefly. I hadn't seen it in a long time.
Craig Glasner says, A Boy and His Dog. Hmm. Ooh.
Let's see. Gary Lindros says... I got a bunch of singles here. So Gary Lindros says Running Man. Mike Robison says Damnation Alley. Michael James Moody says The Postman. And Jack Mangan says Slaughterhouse 5.
Brian Parker said The Godfather. That's interesting. The movie was better than the book. I thought the book was pretty good and the movie as well.
I never read that book.
Sean Brockman says I Am Legend. And Steve London responded back to him. He said, the book and the movie are incomparable. If we're talking about the Will Smith one. Okay. Gary Lindros said, Ready Player One. The book can't do justice to the visuals.
Oh,
He got that backwards, though. We were asking where the movie is better than the book.
Yeah. To be honest with you, I liked them both for different reasons. Now, there was so much more crammed into the book.
Oh, heck yeah.
For sure. But I enjoyed the movie for really the visuals and the somewhat similar story. But yeah. To be honest with you, you know what really sucks about that movie is I don't think it was as good as it should have been. In some ways it's kind of almost forgettable because I don't think about it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of stuff in there that I enjoyed. It's a weird movie, man. You ever had that experience?
Yes. I've gone back and watched movies and went, this looks really familiar. Oh my gosh, I know the whole story because, somewhere in the basement of my brain, it digs up the storyline and goes, I must have watched this, but I really don't remember watching it.
Yeah.
All right, Terry Dawson.
By the way, John Miller Jr. said, Spaceballs, the movie, the book. Two colons in there.
we saw a lady walking around the vendor mart with a backpack on, and it said Loki the backpack. In that Spaceballs font.
Yeah, what's funny is this has nothing to do with Spaceballs, but you totally get it when you read it.
I've got one more. Terry Dawson unloads with the final one. He says Jaws, Blade Runner, Psycho, Shawshank Redemption, Silence of the Lambs, and Clockwork Orange. Wow. Took us to the house on that one.
No kidding.
Thank you very much, everybody who contributed to that. We will have another question for you at the end of the show. Another letter from our listener, Dave. Which means we march right into history time. All right, get out your pencils and paper. It's time for On This Day in History for September 15, 2021. This is the 258th day of the year in the Gregorian calendar. There are 107 days remaining in the year.
There will be a pop quiz after this, by the way.
That's right. That's what our Patreon show is all about.
Yeah.
It was on this date in 1835, the HMS Beagle and with Charles Darwin aboard, reached the Galapagos Islands. The ship landed at Chatham or San Cristobal. Not Crystal Ball. Cristobal. Yeah. The easternmost of the archipelago.
And the American Picture Theater, now the Empire Cinema, the new Empire Cinema, the oldest running cinema in mainland Australia, opened in Brawl, New South Wales, and on this date in 1915.
The new Empire Cinema.
You know, it's the same. You will enjoy this film.
You want to see the manager?
Can I have butter, popcorn? Yeah. It was on this date in 1948 that the F-86 Sabre, you know, the flying jet, it set the world aircraft speed record at 671 miles per hour or 1,080 kilometers per hour.
And I need to change, scoot over a little bit. There we go. Sorry, I've enlarged my font. I had to slide over a little bit. And also on September 15th, 1968, the Soviet Zond 5 spaceship was launched, becoming the first spacecraft to fly around the moon and re-enter the Earth's atmosphere.
Zond. Wasn't he in Superman?
That's right.
Trapped in the Phantom Zone?
Kneel before Zond.
Right. It was also 40 years ago today that the John Bull, becomes the oldest operable steam locomotive in the world when the Smithsonian Institution operated under its own power outside of Washington, D.C. Woo-wee.
Wow.
Happy birthday goes out of this day to French astronomer, mathematician, and politician, and the first mayor of Paris, Jean-Sylvain Bailly, born on this date in 1736.
And James Fenimore Cooper, American novelist, short story writer, and historian, was born on the same date in 1789.
American astronomer and academic Anna Winlock was born 164 years ago today. Same age as Farnsworth.
And Spanish mathematician and engineer, I'm not sure the part of this last name got right, Esteban Terradas Yelio?
Something like that.
Or yeah, it's kind of gets some spaces in there. Yeah. He's born on this date in 1883.
English crime novelist, short story writer, and playwright Agatha Christie was born 130 years ago. 131, excuse me. 13-1-D. No, 11-D-1, 13-1-D.
11-D-31. And born September 15th, 1907, Canadian-American actress Faye Ray.
She was married to King Kong, right?
Sort of.
Yeah, that was the actress. Yeah, okay.
The sequel.
It's a well-known fact. Murray Gell-Mann, the American physicist and academic, Nobel Prize laureate, was born on this date in 1929.
An English singer-songwriter, computer scientist, and author, Stan Kelly Boodle, was born 92 years ago today.
How did we not hear about this guy? He's a singer-songwriter and computer scientist.
Hey, almost like you.
Almost. Not quite.
Except for the scientist and the author and the singer part. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
Just like it. And he's like 40 years older than me. Right. Also born on the same date in 1941, Polish general pilot and astronaut Mirosław Hermaszewski. Wait, I can get this. Hermaszewski? No. It's Zuski. Hermaszewski.
Yeah. Zuski.
Or Hermaszewski.
Don't hurt yourself. Also turning 75 today.
Wait, I
got to
say that just again because it's just so much. Mirosław Hermaszewski. Yes, that's the way it goes.
I'm sorry, sir. Can you spell that last name?
Ach. It's got an ach. It's spelled right. H-E-M phlegm.
And I thought people would get my name wrong. Also turning 75 today is American director, screenwriter, and producer Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone.
Also born on that same date in 1946, American actor, director, producer, and screenwriter, that Tommy Lee Jones. The Men in Black Tommy Lee Jones?
Yes, that one. And also turning 37 today is Duke of Sussex, Prince Harry.
That Prince Harry?
That Prince Harry.
All right, the one with the little boy and the wife, and they moved out of... Yeah, there's a soap opera for you. Put that on the next season.
Sounds like a children's book. He wanted to leave the royalty, and he...
Listener birthdays this week include the 18th of September, Jeff Schultz, a.k.a. Gorbash. The 20th, Joel Harper from Milwaukee. Also, the late, great Joel Rickenbach is also on the 20th. It says here in brackets, deceased.
Oh,
Dean
wow.
Dean Jensen, Beaker One, is on the 21st. We've been podcasting so long that some of our listeners are passing on. They're going to that great big podcast in the sky.
I'd rather hear that they had kids that grew up listening to Technorama.
Some of them have. All right, I think that's about the end of the song, so we better finish this up. That's the way it was on this day in history for September 15, 2021. If you want to be on the Technorama birthday calendar, boom, I got that subtitle for you. Chuckchat.com/birthday. Go over there, get your name out there. We'll give you a shout out at the appropriate time of year. And with that, we play the end. Chuckchat.com/birthday. 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 Okay, now that I got the vocal cords lubed up, let's do the rest of the show. We're ready to start. Let's pick a random button here.
Good news, everyone.
Oh, I said that enough last weekend. Oh, I just said that for the parade.
Hey, by the way, you had a couple of good one-liners. Now, everybody, you know, we didn't necessarily have Dragon Con in person last year. So as we were going through the parade, and Chuck's, of course, dressed as Professor Farnsworth, I heard him making some quips like, "Good news, everyone. The parade, we're back. Dragon Con's back," or something like that.
Yeah, some people like, I got the biggest cheers when I said, "Good news, everyone." Yeah, Dragon Con. Because at first I started out with one lady said, "What's the good news?" And I said, "The parade's over." She goes, "No, the good news is the parade is back." I said, "I'm stealing that from you, young lady." She says, "Go ahead." So I used that for a while, and then I changed it to the parade. The Dragon Con is back, and got more cheers out of that.
Yeah, and our friend Kyle that was doing Zap Brannigan, he actually I think got some of the better lines in there because he was on video twice, two different
on
videos,
the CW but, and on the Dragon Con TV video,
and he's saying. Then he was so
Thanks
happy
for
that everybody
out
came
to
out
see
to
see a parade all about me, Zap
right.
Brannigan, and he was doing a great job with that one.
Yeah,
he gets into his role because when he first started marching with us, he was Fry, and he did like the entire parade singing "I'm Walking on Sunshine."
Yeah, that's why I do. It's hard to sing that because there's people are making noise or whatever, and there's music and stuff. So I don't really sing it, but I'll do moonwalking in the street. You know,
I don't remember Fry doing moonwalking. Did I miss that?
Yeah, he did. That's
oh, okay.
That, yeah.
Let's get on with our good news story.
All right.
In Los Angeles is from KSL.com. NASA's Mars Science Rover Perseverance has collected and stashed away the first of numerous mineral samples that the U.S. Space Agency hopes to retrieve from the surface of the Red Planet for analysis on Earth. Tools attached to the Perseverance and operated by mission specialists from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory near Los Angeles drilled a rock core slightly thicker than a pencil from the ancient Martian lake bed, then hermetically sealed it in a titanium specimen tube inside the rover. The feat, accomplished on September 1st and publicly confirmed by NASA late on Monday, marked the first such mineral sample obtained from the surface of another planet, according to the space agency. NASA chief and former astronaut Bill Nelson hailed it as, quote, a momentous achievement. Okay. The space agency plans to collect as many as 43 mineral samples over the next few months from the floor of Jezero Crater, a wide basin where scientists think water flowed and microbial life may have flourished billions and billions of years ago.
Very nice.
The six-wheeled SUV-sized vehicle is also expected to explore the walls of sediment deposited at the foot of the remnant river delta, once etched into a corner of the crater and considered a prime spot for study. Mineral collection is the heart of the $2.7 billion Perseverance project. Two future missions to Mars to be jointly conducted by NASA and the European Space Agency are planned to retrieve those specimens in the next decade and return them to Earth, where astrobiologists will examine them for signs of tiny fossilized organisms. We gotta wait a decade to get these things back? Why don't they just, you know, Amazon has two-day service.
Let's get, just send them Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime from Mars.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wish they had some way to just eject them into space, and I don't know how else you'd get them home. Yeah, I don't know.
Fly by. I got it. Yeah. I got it.
That's right. Well, we've had moon rocks that landed on Earth.
You would have to launch a rocket that has a probe that launches a lander that launches a rocket back to Earth. Wow. That's a lot of things.
Or as the Starman and the Tesla comes around Mars, he just picks it up and brings it back to Earth.
Are they really coming around Mars?
What's that?
Is the Tesla man, is the Starman coming around Mars?
Yeah, I think is he not already, we'll have to go look at his trajectory. I think he's already passed the Mars. It's been a couple
of years. Yeah, they said in 2 years, we'll be able to see him again from Earth.
So Starman position.
Current Starman position.
In space. Let's see. Where is Starman? Let's take a look. There's a picture of him. He is currently.
Yes.
The Roadster is.
Crashed into
already
the sun.
Past Earth. So yeah, it's. You have to look
well,
at.
Well, we totally missed that news story. How's he doing?
He's probably a little ragged by now. I don't know.
He needs a. He's missed his 5,000 mile oil change.
Right.
By quite a bit.
Right. I'm not sure when we'll see him. Oh, well.
All right.
So have you ever wondered how your cats get stripes? I know yours didn't have stripes.
Yeah, Lisa's cat has stripes. I was just calling him today, Mr. Striped Kitty.
Oh, I was thinking of Todd.
Todd, no, he's all black.
Yeah. I mean, he's got stripes under there. You just don't see him.
He's black on black.
Yeah, that's right. He likes AC/DC too.
That's back in black.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. So you ever wonder how your favorite fur line got its stripes? A new study of domestic cats.
Your favorite fur line? Well, you made up a new word. Your favorite fur line.
Well, if he's got stripes, it's a fur line, right? Right?
So is my beard.
Right. Okay. Let me stop laughing here. So a new study of domestic cats has revealed which genes give felines their distinctive fur patterns and hints that the same genetics may grant wildcats, such as tigers and cheetahs, their characteristic coats. So how cats get their stripes is a decade-old mystery in the life sciences. Senior author Gregory Barsh, a geneticist at the Hudson Alpha Institute for Biotechnology in Huntsville, Alabama, told Live Science in such an email, about 70 years ago, scientists began developing theories as to why and how organisms come to bear periodic patterns, such as stripes on a zebra or the squiggly segments of a caterpillar's body. By the way, on the way home from Atlanta, you know, we were just talking about that. We saw a horse trailer that had a zebra in it.
You sure it was a zebra?
Well, at first, I saw what looked like fabric. I thought it was like a blanket, you know, with a pattern on it in the horse trailer. And Kim goes, no, there was a zebra in there. It had its nose up, was at the slats, you know, so it was getting some air.
Zebras you can't domesticate a zebra. What are they doing with that? I wonder if they're moving it from one zoo to another.
I think that might be the case because we had passed Columbia and there's a Columbia Zoo. Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling they were taking it somewhere. So anyway, it's like, well, that's a zebra. Anyway, so some animals, like a zebrafish, these patterns emerge due to the arrangement of different types of cells. But the mammals, in mammals, the skin and hair cells are exactly the same across the entire body, and color patterns come out because of differences in genetic activity between, say, cells underlying a dark stripe and cells underlying a light stripe, Barsh said. So the question of how cats get their stripes comes down to how and when various genes switch on their cells and how those genes influence the animal's development. In short, it's complicated. So did they really solve anything here?
No, they've been wasting money studying this stuff that nobody... What value does this have?
I don't know.
Why should we care? Why are you spending money on this?
I don't know. Anyway, they did it.
I'm sure genetic studies will advance somehow, because if they can figure out this, then maybe they can alter the genes in, say, your hair, and then people get striped hair.
Pattern baldness.
Maybe. Wait. And you'll look like a zebra. There, you're not bald anymore, but your camo.
Hey, Chuck, we got good news and bad news. We got your hair back, but it's zebra striped.
Which is fine, because, you know, the deer are colorblind anyway. They won't see you coming if you're hunting for them in the woods.
That's right. Should I continue, or are we done with this one?
We're done with that one.
Okay. All right, fine. All right. Well, cat's got stripes. How about that?
Surprise. We have another story about Planet Nine. We haven't talked about Planet Nine in quite some time. From NBCNews.com, astronomer Michael Brown, yes, that Michael Brown, the one behind the demotion of Pluto, led the campaign that controversially demoted Pluto in 2006 from the ninth planet of our solar system into just one of its many dwarf planets. Wait, I need this one. Now he hopes to fill the gap he created with what he predicts to be the discovery of a, quote, Planet Nine. Wait, wasn't that in...
That's a movie.
No, yeah, that was in Buckaroo Banzai, wasn't it?
It was also it wasn't an operating system.
Planet Nine from Outer Space. No, that was Plan Nine from Outer Space.
Yeah, Plan Nine from Outer Space.
Planet Nine was it, where are we going? Planet Nine, when are we going there? Real soon. Okay, a planet many
times...
That's
Plan 9 from Bell Labs, by the way.
Planet 9 is supposed to be a planet many times the size of the Earth, and it might orbit the sun far beyond Neptune. It was definitely not the intention, says Brown, a professor of planetary astronomy at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, and the author of the memoir, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. Oh, Walt Disney's going to be all over your case, buddy. You killed his little dog. Quote, if I were prescient enough to have had all these ideas ahead of time and then demoted Pluto and found a new Planet Nine, then that would be brilliant. But it really is just a coincidence, he said. A study published online in August by Brown and his colleague at Caltech, astrophysicist Konstantin Batygin, examines the evidence for a proposal they first suggested in 2016. That the hypothetical Planet Nine could explain anomalies seen by astronomers in the outer solar system, especially the unusual clustering of icy asteroids in cometary cores called Kuiper Belt objects. The study has been accepted for publication by the Astronomical Journal, according to National Geographic. Despite years of looking, Planet Nine has never been seen. As a result, some astronomers have suggested it doesn't exist. Yeah, that's what they said about Bigfoot, too.
Yeah.
And the clustering of objects noted by Brown and Batygin is the result of observation bias. Since fewer than a dozen objects have been seen, their clustering might be a statistical fluke that wouldn't be seen among the hundreds thought to exist. For their latest study, however, Brown and Batygin have added several recent observations of objects, and they've calculated that the clustering is almost certainly real. In fact, they found there is only a 0.4% chance that it's a fluke. Hmm. That would suggest Planet Nine is almost certainly there. And the new studies included a treasure map, in quotes, of its supposed orbit that tells astronomer the best places in the sky to look for it. It's way out there. So
I know they've been looking for it for a long time. I remember, I think we even talked about it on this very show, that they found evidence of, what was it, the way they were looking at the stars, they were seeing something move, and it was causing a distortion in the light. So they thought that was Planet Nine.
Planet Nine wouldn't be big enough to distort the light. You need a lot of gravity.
No, no. I mean, from, stars in the distance, is they not distort it so much, but more or less block it out.
Okay.
You know, so they thought that that was Planet Nine. So
could be.
Yeah.
Could be. All right. You got one more news story for us?
I do. And we got all the time in the world to talk about this one.
No, we don't.
It's what the world's most accurate clock can tell us about Earth and the cosmos. Speaking of space, say it would take 15 billion years for the clocks that occupies the Yong Yi's basement lab at the University of Colorado to lose a second about how long the university has existed.
No, the universe, not the university. The university has not been around of Colorado. Yeah, that's a really old university if it's been here 15 billion years. Yeah. I'd like to apply for a loan.
Hey, good news. We got a newest, oldest university. For the invention, the Chinese-American scientist, along with Hidetoshi Katori of Japan, will split $3 million as co-winners of the 2022. Wait, we hadn't had 2022 yet.
Well, it's like a magazine. You know, they always predate it.
Yeah, get September and May.
We just did On This Day in History for 3 days in the future. Why not?
That's right. We're predicting the future, the past. Anyway, the 2022 Breakthrough Prize in Fundamental Physics. Working independently, the two develop techniques using lasers to trap and cool atoms, then harness their vibrations to drive what are known as optical lattice clocks, the most precise timekeeping pieces ever built.
Takes a licking and keeps on ticking.
That's right. By comparison, current atomic clocks lose a second every 100 million years.
I can't stand for that lack of precision.
I hate it when that happens. But what is gained by a greater accuracy? It's really an instrument to allow you to probe the basic fabric of space and time in the universe. You know, if you're off 1 second and you travel in time, you could be screwed, or a wall could be in your way, right?
You could find yourself flying through an asteroid, kid. You got to.
That's right. In Yi's lab, researchers have shown that time moves slower when the clock is moved closer to the ground by a matter of centimeters, in line with Einstein's predictions of relativity. Applied to current technology, these clocks could improve GPS navigation accuracy by a factor of 1,000, or help smoothly land an unmanned space plane on Mars.
Wait. Improve GPS navigation accuracy by a factor of 1,000? You mean it'll actually tell me when to turn left accurately?
Yeah.
That's a right. Fence. I'm not turning left into a fence.
You're a fence? I'm offended. A fence?
No.
Come on. So.
Do you want to go through, Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time?
So speaking of which, improving the precision and accuracy of timekeeping has been a goal since ancient Egyptians and Chinese made sundials. A key breakthrough came with the invention of the pendulum clock in 1656, which relies on a swinging weight to keep time. And a few decades later, chronometers were accurate enough to determine a ship's longitude at sea. Let's see. Anyway, you can go look at all that, but there's some pictures about from the clock that they developed. Yeah, I always wondered why would it matter to lose 1 second over 100 million years when it won't lose it in our lifetime, right? What do I care?
But can they fit it into the size of something that will fit on my wrist?
Yeah, I've got a timepiece too.
Hook that anyway. Up to the what is it? NIST? Who keeps the national or the international time now?
I think you're right, NIST.
All right, let's move on because we have
the doctor does.
We have a Hacks and Strange Stories for you. This is not. This is Tectorama newsworthy right here. The 10% of your brain myth that just won't die.
I only have 8%.
Aww. With headlines like this, you know what you're in for. You've likely heard this wild and wildly misinformed idea that, in one form or another, we humans only use 10% of our brain. Like a horror movie monster, the myth just won't die. Various scientists and science journalists think they've killed it, but as soon as they start to relax, it comes roaring back. The fact is, this notion is not even close to true. It's not clear how it got started, but writers seem to think the myth can be tracked back to the popular 1936 self-help book written by public speaking teacher Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Many people have heard of that book. Many people have read it. I've read it. It's a good book. And Carnegie likely expanded on a similar concept proposed by American physiologist William James. In a 1907 article first published in Science, James wrote, "Compared with what we ought to be, we are only half awake. Our fires are damped, our drafts are checked. We are making use of only a small part of our possible mental and physical resources." Well, that passage certainly has flair, especially the way I read it, and a bit of urgency. But it does not suggest that we only use 10% of our brains. It's also not very catchy. Probably it was the very specificity of that 10% number, whoever first tacked it on, that made the myth go viral, as we say today. It's quite possible that Dale Carnegie's marketing genius made that idea stickier by attributing it directly to the brain and putting a number on it, says Sandra Ahmad, neuroscientist and author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. That is an awesome book title.
Yeah.
Let me just read that book title again in case you're looking for it on Amazon. Welcome to Your Brain, : Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life. Sounds like a must read. However it started, it spread widely. People all over the world believe it, says Ahmad. One survey about 10 years ago found that half of Brazilians believe that you only use 10% of your brain. I can't imagine they were sitting around reading Dale Carnegie. Then again, his bestseller was translated in nearly every known language. I want to know how many zeros are in half a Brazilian. It says they found that half of Brazilians... Anyway, never mind.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Ultimately, the idea was gold to self-improvement gurus. Quote, if the 10% myth had not existed, the self-improvement crusaders would have had to invent it, neuroscientist Barry L. Bernstein wrote in an article about this myth published in the book Mind Myths, Exploring Popular Assumptions About the Mind and the Brain. These people can't write short book titles, can they?
No, they cannot.
Welcome to the long book titles, Neuroscientists write very long book title articles. Quote, we think that people are excited by this pseudo-fact because it's very optimistic, unquote, says Ahmad. Wouldn't we all love to think our brains had some giant pool of untapped potential that we're not using? The alternative, she adds, means we must face the reality of our limitations and the challenges of learning. Alas, the 10% myth is simply not true. There's absolutely no room for doubt about this, Ahmad says. Functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, has shown that all parts of the brain are active during various activities. Not all at the same time, of course, but every part of the brain has a job to do. And neuroscientists can tell you pretty much what the various parts do. The attribution of particular functions is to particular parts of the brain got its start during World War II, which unfortunately sent a lot of people home with brain injuries. Studying veterans and testing them to see what they could do and couldn't do depending on where their brains were damaged was one of the earliest types of studies done to figure out what different parts of the brain do. Later, surgeons figured out which parts of the brain do what by electrically stimulating the brain during surgery or to treat epilepsy. Before cutting into the brain, Ahmad explained, surgeons had to make sure they weren't going to accidentally damage the part of the brain necessary for some important function. Language, for example. Maybe running the heart or lungs
might be
nice, too. We're just talking about, you know. They stimulated the areas around where they were planning to cut and asked the patient what just happened. I saw a blue flash. Sometimes people laughed. Sometimes they remembered something that had happened when they were 8 years old, she says. But what never happens is nothing. Mm-hmm. So while the brain still has its mysteries, yes, of course, for example, how does it create consciousness? One thing we do know is that all of it, not just 10% of it, is on the job. That might not be bad news, though. In recent years, scientists have learned that the brain is far more plastic than we used to think, able to create new pathways for new tasks or recover from damage. Our brains might not have huge untapped reserves, but they have. But what they do have is pretty remarkable. Good stuff. I like brain articles.
You know, it always freaked me out the first time I found out that when they do brain surgery, you know, the usually the patient is awake.
Yes.
And they have them doing something.
And it doesn't like, hurt.
You ever seen that lady doing the playing the violin while they were working? And it's just freaky. You know, it just freaked me out, you know, thinking about that.
Reminds me of our Star Trek panel. Brain and brain. What is brain? Okay. Let's give a quick shout out to the chat room because we do have a few people.
Hey, by the way, if you want to hear that, go over to the topic is Trek.
Ding.
And .com. You can hear it for yourself. We posted the Dragon Con panel from Topic is Trek the other day. So
live script reading. You might recognize some of the voices.
Yeah, it was fun. And I should have gotten that guy's name. The guy was playing Spock, the intercom Spock. He did a great job.
And he also did Sulu's line too.
That's right. He did Sulu's line too.
He'll
did a great job. So go over and listen to him. I wish I captured his name, but I did not.
If you know who it is by voice, let us know.
Yeah.
All right. That brings, chat. Oh, we got to do the live chat thing. I've got, we mentioned Gary Lindros, Mike Robeson, John Miller Jr., Eric Miller. Mm-hmm. You see anybody else in there?
No.
All right. There were a couple on Facebook or YouTube, but they went away. So if you want to hang out with us, you can do so on Sunday nights at 9:30 Eastern time. Set your calendars, mark your watch. No, set your watch and mark your calendars. That might work better.
Yeah, make sure it's within a second of 100 million
15 years, billion years. You don't want to miss a second of this.
That's right.
Even though it feels like sometimes this show is 15 billion years long.
That's right. Each one.
Thank you very much for everybody who hangs out with us. We enjoy your company. You make the chat more lively and engaging, and people sometimes have these little side discussions that have nothing to do with what we're talking about, which is even more fun. So hang out with us again. Sunday is 9:30 Eastern time on Facebook or YouTube if you prefer, and we will see you there, which leads us to, yes, it's Remember When time. I think it's your turn to read.
All right. So there, this article is about six hacker pioneers who turned the early internet onto its head.
Okay.
Really, it's one of those articles was a slideshow, but I thought it would be interesting to at least flip through some of these.
Who are these people of which you speak?
All right. So first off, we have Kevin Mitnick.
No surprise.
Yeah. I mean, he did a lot of phone hacking early on, but and from a very early age, Mitnick was reportedly a computer whiz and a skill set that quickly, I hate being referred to as a computer whiz. You ever had somebody call you that?
Sounds like cheese whiz, like you're the cheaper version of a real computer.
Charles, he's a computer whiz. Anyway, so he is said to have hacked into numerous large organizations, Pac Bell, Motorola, Nokia, Digital Equipment, DEC, and others, and has long rumored to have hacked the North American Defense Command, which, NORAD, they oversee Santa each year. America's Underground Nuclear Command Center, and as a teenager, thus inspiring the classic hacker film War Games.
He wasn't a malicious hacker though. He was curious, but he didn't like laud it over people's heads and go. A lot of times he'd say, "Hey, I broke into your system. You might want to make it more secure." And that's where they started coming down on his case.
Yeah, I don't remember him being.
What was the book
malicious?
I read? Ghost in the Wire or something like that. There's a that book about familiar. His story. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting if you want to know more about Kevin Mitnick. Who else is on this crazy list?
All right, so Robert Tappan Morris, of the Morris Worm. So credited with being the first guy to invent an internet worm and the first to be arrested for it, Morris was an interesting figure, and like a lot of other hackers in the era, very unlikely criminal. A graduate of Harvard, Morris was continuing his academic career at Cornell University when he created a computer program that wrecked a whole lot of havoc. The worm, which originated in MIT servers, was unfurled on November 2nd, 1988, subsequently causing a widespread denial of service attack that affected much of the existing internet at the time.
I remember that.
I do remember that. It's unclear whether it is intentional or accidental or accidentally malicious, but whatever the case, the worm ate its way through approximately 10% of the computers connected to the web at the time. Was it the web at the time? It wasn't called the web at the time.
No, it was the internet. There was no web in 1988.
Yeah. Admittedly, it was a relatively small number, leaving many of them in a wounded, zombified state. It became known as the Morris worm.
Oh, let me do the next one.
So, yeah, go ahead.
Wow, they have a picture of an IBM PS2 in here. Imagine that. Yeah. Okay, technically, this isn't just one hacker. It's several. One of the many hacking groups to crop up during the 1980s, the 414s. Is it 414s or 414s?
Yes.
I don't know. That was the area code of Milwaukee and Northeast Wisconsin for a long time. Well, they were a small team of pimply-faced teenagers and early 20-somethings from Milwaukee. Ah! That's where they get their name. It's the area code.
Yeah, you're right. There you go.
They managed to hack into networks of a myriad large governmental facilities, banks, and other organizations. Targets included the likes of Los Alamos National Laboratory, Sloan Kettering, and Security Pacific National Bank. Then, one of the largest banks in California. Eventually, they would be paid a visit by the FBI, and several members of the group would eventually face charges for making harassing phone calls.
Hmm.
Is your refrigerator running?
Do you have Prince Albert in a can?
Exactly. Okay. Tell us about this next pimply face kid.
Hey, by the way, that picture on that article you're just talking about?
Yes.
What's funny is nowadays I see the picture. He's got a football picture on the screen. And my first thought was, wow, they're making it look like he's streaming a football game.
No, he just spent 20 minutes downloading a GIF.
An animated GIF.
No, it wasn't even animated back in the 80s.
Yeah. So Mark Abeen, who went by the outlandish hacker moniker of Fiber Optic,
spelled with a PH and a K on Optic. And a K. Nice.
Was a member of the hacking group Masters of Deception. As a minor, Abeen is alleged to have been involved in an assortment of small computer hacking crimes. Some say a victim of the federal government's crackdown on hackers in the 90s. Abeen and other members of the MOD were arrested in 1991 and subsequently indicted by a federal grand jury.
Ouch.
He was ultimately sentenced to 12 months in prison. After his release, he maintained a reputation of a kind of folk hero of the hacking community and has since gone on to enjoy a long career in cybersecurity and other IT endeavors, according to his LinkedIn bio.
That's where a lot of them ended up. They're like, hey, you're pretty good at this. You want to...
Kevin Mitnick. That's exactly what he did.
You want to be a consultant and help us protect ourselves against people like you? All right.
David, hey, wait. Didn't they use it, a thing for him at work, wasn't it? Some security training a couple years ago?
Free Mitnick.
Yeah.
A little over 10 years after the Morris worm wreaked its havoc, computer viruses had evolved quite a bit, and David L. Smith, a programming subcontractor for AT&T, helped cement the intrusive power of the malicious program. In 1999, Smith authored and launched the Melissa virus.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I remember that. All right.
A self-propagating program that, when opened, forwarded itself to the first 50 people in your Microsoft Outlook address book. Ah, another reason why not to use Outlook. The virus purportedly caused millions of dollars in damages. After being arrested, Smith was sentenced to a stint in federal prison.
All right. And next up, we have Julian Assange. Before he became a controversial publisher and... U.S. Authorities, alleged international criminal, Julian was your type of teenage hacker hellbent on notoriety and achievement. Under the name Mendix, Assange began hacking in 1987 at the age of 16. While the exact exploits of an early era Assange was not totally confirmed, he is rumored to have helped hack into NASA, and his friends are said to have boasted of hacking who's who of the U.S. military industrial complex. What is known that in 91, he and his cyber comrades were caught hacking into Nortel, a large Canadian telecom.
Yep.
As a result,
Yeah, I remember Nortel. We used Nortel phone system for a long time in our old company.
That's right. As a result, Assange was arrested and charged in Australian authorities with 31 related charges.
Ouch.
He was later graduated to bigger things, founding WikiLeaks, famous hacktivism organization, so on and so forth. So, yep.
All right. Julian Assange. Number 8 of 8. Oh, it's just a slide that says, check out these other slideshows.
Really, I don't like slideshow articles.
Disappointing.
Just give me a list.
Yeah. Find out these celebrities and their embarrassing moments.
Chuck Tomasi was in 1991 charged with 8. What?
No. We said we'd never talk about that on the show.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay. That's right. It was expunged.
What we will talk about is our Patreon people, because they're awesome. They're the people who keep this show going. In fact, they afforded us some opportunities this past weekend at Dragon Con. So thank you very much to Alexis Duran, Amber Elstad, Amy Bowen. Thank you, Abner Braverman, Ben Vaughn, Brian Brown, Chris MC. Thank you, Dan D. Man Coyer. Thank you, Dean Jensen, Denise Inglis, Gary Lindros. We hung out with him quite a bit. Thank you, Harold McKinstry, yes. John Clifford, John Noble, Yorga Shrawan, Christina. Thank you, Kyle Nishioka and Leon and Mark Kilfoyle. Much appreciation to Mike Wills, Chris Martinez, Saturday Morning Media, and the four Steves. Stephen Weshey, Steve Therian, Steve Cody, and Steve London.
Why are you laughing at Weshey's name?
Because my brain is so wired to the original way Weshey. We said it that I couldn't remember which way it was.
Oh.
No.
Oh. When it wets
you. If you want to become a patron, pardon me for my Patreon perpetuity, you can go to our Patreon page. I think that's the one. Yes, there it is. Patreon.com/Technorama Podcast. We would love to call your name out on each episode and sign you up for the optional RSS feed for the Patreon content. Because right after we record this show, and before we release this show, we have sort of a backstage pass for you where Craig and I talk about odd bits and bytes that happen between. So look forward to that.
Bits and bytes. I see what you did there.
Patreon.com/Technorama Podcast. All right. Wait a minute. You just snuck something in on me.
I did a little bit. That's all right. You don't have to play the thing. I was just going to talk about it.
Oh, no. You can't talk about it with us playing the song.
All right. Here, pick the remote.
This one?
Yeah, that's it.
Cheesy effect number 12. Wait, you sent me a motion detector. What?
It's magic.
And it's broken, too.
It's broken. There's no motion in that ocean.
Careful.
So, really, I didn't watch anything new, per se, but I just wanted to shout out to Star Trek. You know, last week was 55 years on September 8th.
Hooray!
Yay. So I've been kind of on a tear of Star Trek. I watched I don't know if you caught any of it, but it was the Star Trek Celebration online from Paramount, which was really, it's kind of weird. It was more of an advertisement for all the new shows that are coming up. You know, they were showing clips and announcing stuff, cast members, that kind of thing for Star Trek shows that are coming. But it was kind of fun to watch. And I watched that the other night, and I've been kind of bouncing around watching. I do the Google rewards, you know, on my phone, where they send you a survey and you fill out a few questions.
I've got about $18 in there right now.
I had 50.
Holy smokes.
I bought a few things. I was like, well, I needed to buy something because some of it expires.
I think it's a year or so.
Yeah. So I had some in there and I'm like, okay, I bought all the first 10 movies. It was like a set, a digital set, if you will. So I bought all the 10 movies. I've been kind of bouncing around that. And of course, watched Lower Decks and stuff like that. But anyway, I just wanted to give a shout out to Star Trek for 55 years. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Hey. Sound effects are a little slow tonight.
And it seems like we've been deep into Star Trek for a long time, because we've been doing the topic of Trek. We had our Dragon Con panel. We even wore our Lower Decks uniforms, you know, all that stuff. So it just seems like I've been knee deep in Star Trek for the last several months.
I think it was it Monday where my insurrection / the gray and black.
DS9.
Yeah. No, DS9 mm-hmm. didn't do the black and gray. Insurrection and maybe that was DS9 in the later years.
Yeah, I had the little I'm looking at it right here. It has Cisco has the red shirt under with the gray shoulders.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they started off with the colored shoulders.
Right.
And they end up swapping them. They had the gray Dickies, and then all of a sudden they had the gray shoulders with the red under it, which I like that uniform.
I do too. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a good one. All right.
We have in the Geek Library 13 completely bonkers gold key Star Trek covers.
Yeah, I've got some of these. I do have some of these books. Not all of them. I wish I did. But I do have some of the. And so not so much an article to read as it is some of these covers. And I'll read a little bit here. It says, Star Trek, the greatest sci-fi franchise in history of humankind. I'll let your dissenting opinions float around there. Debuted 55 years ago on September 8th, 1966. We posted quite a bit. This is on the 13thdimension.com website. We posted quite a bit about Gene Roddenberry's original series over the years. But this time we're doing something I can't believe we haven't done before. And they're 13 completely bonkers gold key Star Trek covers, mostly by the great George Wilson, and intentionally omitting the early photo covers. It's more like there's photo covers. The comic series ran from 67 to 79. Oh, and go watch Amok Time tonight. It's their number one pick of the Star Trek episode. I think they were doing a countdown. So if you go look at the covers, I like the art of these covers. They're a little bit in the vein of some of the old pulp sci-fi magazines you can find on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can find some of those on the internet archive. Names escape me there.
Death grazes the Enterprise crew when 10,000-year-old mummies come to life. Oh, I missed that episode.
There's one. Actually, if you look at this, you'll see some hints of some of the styles I think we saw in like the Kelvin Universe movies, where they were underwater and they had the swimsuits. There's a couple of them. They're underwater. Let's see, where's it at? There's one cover that has. Yeah. Anyway, maybe they don't have that one here.
Behold,
but you can see
the idol who demands the death of three strangers. It's a statue of Spock. What?
Right. And here's Spock's swollen brain grapples with insanity to save a planet's culture. I think we saw that episode.
Yeah, pretty much.
What was the other? Oh, ancient Greek deities force Kirk and Spock on an odyssey of peril. I think I got that one. I think I actually got that cover.
The Enterprise and her crew are snared in a wizard's magic. Oh, no, that hasn't happened yet.
There's one here. Looks like a baby sneezing, and Kirk and Spock are baby or young kids. So
the animal people, they lived like beasts, but rebelled like men. That sounds a bit redundant, but okay.
Yeah, it's funny. So go check them out. You can find some of these online, some of these old comics. I've got some, of course, you know, my mom wrote my name on them and stuff like that. But
the artwork is good. 13thdimension.com. You can find the show notes over at chuckchat.com/technorama, episode 650.
Oh, head on over. By the way, yes. In Dog Days of Podcasting a couple years ago, you and Clinton helped me voice one of these. I took the
one of these?
Yeah, one of these comics. I took the
not one of these 10 that were here.
Yeah, I remember I scanned the comic so you guys could read the script. Right.
But it wasn't one of these 10.
It was one of these. I don't remember exactly which one.
Oh.
Because I was reviewing comics.
Didn't look familiar.
Yeah. So I may we may have to do that again. I thought it was fun. Did you think it was fun?
Yeah, it was fun. What else is fun? Well, the hour is up and we are gonna get out of here. Our question of the week for you is which actor / actress is instantly recognizable whenever you hear their voice.
And I will say James Earl Jones is exempt from this.
Morgan Freeman, then.
Morgan Freeman. Samuel Jackson. Yeah. Keith David has another one. All right, we named them all.
Yep, there you go. Let's see what other people come up with. Okay, that brings us to the end. We better play the music and get on out of here. Make like a screen door and get out. No, wait. Make like a
slam it.
Make like a tree.
Make like
and
a screen door and slam it.
make like a screen door on a battleship. I'm just messing up the messed up stuff. Because that's what this show does. We mess it up even more. Oh, thank you very much to everybody. If you want to get in touch with us on the listener line, you can do so at 707-530-2428. Get that contact information up on the screen for those of you that are watching. 707-530-CHAT is how you can get a hold of us. Or you can send us an email like Lee John did, technorama@chuckchat.com. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got feedback, comments, or anything, suggestions, we're here for you. Not like a support line kind of thing. We're not doing that this time.
Yeah, we're not live.
But thank you. Let's hang out again soon. And Craig, give him a binary high five.
All right, 101, everybody. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. See you next time.